not to be too disappointed, but I'm not going to talk much about my fish work today. I will instead talk about evolution, physics meets biology. And I thought this was a fitting title until I realized that Simon had already presented the basics of it in his talk. Physics characterized as kind of these stiff, constraining properties, and biology is somehow rearranging that despite its, our best efforts. And I think this applies to the eye because, in fact, eye evolution is biology trying to meet the hard constraints of the physics of light. Okay, so today I'll talk about the constraints on eye production, diversity of eyes, history of the evolution of eye thinking, diversity versus specialization, are there clues in this for evolution? What kind of evidence can we use for eye evolution? Can we use development, lenses, phototransduction cascades? And then talk a little bit about a modeling system which suggests that how fast an eye could evolve. And I'll speculate some. If there's time, I'll talk about an alternate universe of photo detection. Maybe, although maybe this physics will be transported somewhere else by this. So let me just start by saying, you know, there are 30 animal phyla. About a third have eyes. A third have some kind of light detection, meaning some kind of photodetective spot. And a third have really no specialization for detecting light at all. And this first third that have eyes are, of course, the ones that we all know about. The rest really haven't made a lot of progress on our planet. Light is obviously the premier selective force. It carries, as you know, energy and information. There have been about 10 to the 15th sunrises and sunsets. I have this from Stephen Hawking, who I guess maybe some of you could correct this number, but it's about right. And it has information about time of day, as well as real information about form and figures in the world. We only see a small part of that spectrum, and you probably wondered why, despite the fact that sunlight has a lot of energy in it that extends really into quite longer wavelengths. And the reason seems to be that when you look at the relationship between water and EM radiation, water attenuates light, or attenuates EM radiation rather dramatically, except in this resonant region right here, which is where eyes evolved. This explains also why some animals use electroreception, so they're electric fish that use weakly electric signals. They didn't obviously evolve eyes because the eyes would have to be large relative to the wavelength of that radiation, which would give them eyes like the size of the planet, making them hard to imagine. This also explains, for those of you who wondered, why your radio doesn't work underwater and your TV. So basically, this just says that's where there was a biochemical window where evolution could have started. These have now stayed with us because that's the nature of evolutionary steps. They fundamentally produce a product, and then if it works, they keep it. So even after we came out onto land, there have been only minor modifications since then. So obviously, the properties of light constrain eye structures. And we think of this, as biologists, as that light travels in straight lines, it reflects, it refracts, that spectral content can be polarized. These are the properties that eyes have evolved to exploit. And recently, you may have seen in Nature a story where there's one animal that can detect rotational polarization. And it's quite an amazing suite of things that animals have been able to pull out of light. So, and I would say that in the best cases, eyes can extract information about where and what an object is. That's how we think of our eyes. They do lots of other things, and you'll see that as I go along. So, despite these constraining features, eyes appear to be quite diverse. So here is the only known case of a pinhole camera eye, the chambered nautilus. That's its eye right there. It has no lens. It has just a small modifiable pupil. Here are scallops. You may have had these in sushi restaurants. They take the eyes off. These are them hanging in the mantle. They're really quite unusual eyes that have a mirror rather than a lens, and I'll talk about them a little bit more. They act really as photodetection devices so that when something comes up and tries to reach in to eat them like a bird, they will clamp down rather quickly. That's a scallop. And here are starfish. They have their eyes in their feet. So basically when they don't have an equivalent of Facebook, but if they were going to check out a female, they would look at her like this. And they basically have five eyes that are distributed that way. Here's an animal you might know, the mosquito, taking a bite with these faceted eyes that we are pretty familiar with. Here's the fruit fly, the most studied eye perhaps on the planet. These hairs detect when something's on its eye. And it is a beautiful arrangement of highly organized hexagonal units that contain eight photoreceptor subtypes. Chambered eyes that we think of as our own eyes and most land vertebrates are not limited to us. Here's a jumping spider. These with an EM picture have beautiful chambered eyes. They don't move their eyes, so they have evolved 8 eyes around the top of their head. And the eyes have different functions, so these are estimators of distance. These are female detectors. These are sort of looking for predators around the back of your head. So they're really quite interesting, and they're functionally specialized as tested in a variety of really cool experiments. They're also brightly colored. Here's the guy looking at you, ready to jump on you if you're the right kind of object. They also have pretty amazing adaptations. So you've all seen eye shine. That's to give the eye a second chance at getting a photon. Here's a picture from the Serengeti of, actually, these are hyenas. There's a lion kill right down here, and they're waiting for their turn once the lions leave that kill. That's the pupillum from their eyes. So animals that live in dim light actually have a lot of this kind of eye shine. They also need to see both in air and in water. That's a real problem, as you can imagine, and that's done with a distensible lens in the case of birds. And when you don't get it right, the consequences are pretty severe if you're a bird that has not judged underwater correctly. Some animals have evolved the ability to see in the UV. So here are bees. You may wonder how they choose which plant to pollinate. They actually see in the UV and can detect when that plant has been pollinated. Here's a normal plant, here's a plant in the UV, and it has a very different kind of features, set of features, basically, that you can't see with the normal visual system. So let me now turn to the short history of thoughts on eye evolution. Darwin said, basically, this is a tough problem, and you know that this is a long and wonderful quote in which he said, however, he was not at all worried that evolution would ultimately have solved this problem. I thought I would shorten it here. Ernst Mayr and one of his students set the next published work on real contribution to evolution of eyes was in over 100 years later, where they said, looking at a large number of animals and their development and their morphology, well, there must have been 40 to 65 different kinds of eyes originally, and these radiated into the planet. In 1979, Outram, a famous German scientist who had then begun to look at the opsin family, and said, well, all these eyes use some common molecule, an opsin, so it must be that there was a single origin, inferring that since they use the same molecule, they must have arisen from the same source. This is the monophyletic argument. In 1992, Mike Land and I went through and looked at this question again. And by then, there were enough sequences to determine that opsin had evolved before there were eyes, so it preceded eyes. And we proposed in an article that probably there were multiple origins. A really amazing study in 1996 by Walter Gehrig showed that you could use one particular gene called PAX6, a paired homeobox gene, and induce eyes in a very limited range across the front end of a Drosophila, namely on its legs and so forth. And there were a whole series of studies went from that and really proposed that this PAX6 was a master regulatory gene. And I think there was a lot of excitement, and it really reactivated people thinking about evolution, and especially about eye evolution, because of this master gene hypothesis. Since then, however, as you'll see today, we think that eyes actually preceded the bilateria, so that fundamentally there had to have been multiple origins, and I think that's the thrust of this talk. So you'll hear today that there were probably multiple origins, and I think when Todd talks, you'll hear about origins of photoreceptors in addition. Okay, so even though there seem to be a lot of different kinds of eyes, the optical systems are not that diverse, and that reflects the idea that the physics of light has really constrained the ways that eyes can collect light. So here is a set of are thinking about how optical systems in chambered eyes actually might have evolved. So there was first a pit eye. In each of these diagrams, this little region around here is the photoreceptive part. And a pit eye means there were no optics, but as long as it began to shape into a sphere, you could get directionality from that kind of eye. And you could ultimately, by making that hole smaller, you could actually get quite good orientation in space. And so there was this direction that it went, and it went in the direction of the scallop. Here, the scallop has a mirrored lens at the back here. So light comes through the retina, which is this fuzzy part there, and then comes back and is detected, and these mirrors actually focus the light on this retina. Of course, it's not a very good detection system because it has seen each photon twice, so to speak, once as it passes through the retina and once as it's focused. So it's kind of a blurry image, and attempts to figure this out have been puzzling, but it's clearly good for light detection. And then we can think of the lens eye, so the lens is then evolved. And that's a very fascinating story that I'll go through just briefly in a minute. And with lenses at the front of the eye, then there's a better collection, more focus. You can get obviously much more collection, a greater collection of light for sure. Some eyes I won't talk about have multiple lenses. These can be moved around, different elements can be moved, and they produce an amazing different kind of almost telephoto effect. And for animals that live underwater, there's a real problem because they need to have a lot of refractive power in the lens itself. That means the lens typically has to be spherical, and spherical aberration is a big problem. And so all the animals that live underwater and have lenses have evolved gradient index lenses. It means there's a gradient of refractive index across the lens itself. That has been a real interesting study. That's what the Rank Prize was for, is figuring out how this works and how it not only solves chromatic aberration, but also spherical aberration. And then finally, the terrestrial eye, where you resolve a lot of these problems by having the eye quite large, having a distensible lens, so you can actually focus the lens. You release a lot of the constraints by getting onto land and not having this water problem. So the cornea produces a whole new refractive element, providing more refractive power for us than the lens itself. So terrestrial eyes are sort of, I guess you'd say now, very well studied, but somehow the least interesting in terms of helping us with evolution. And the evolutionary problem is, of course, there aren't real good residues of soft tissue like this in evolutionary history, so they're not fossils of eyes. They did not fossilize in a very useful way. So despite this great apparent diversity, there are only 8 eye types that have evolved over 500 million years. They fall into 2 big categories: chambered eyes, that is, eyes that have a large chamber with the photoreceptor surface on the back, and compound eyes. In all these, this diagram, the photodetection area, which is the retina, will be shown in this sort of purple color. So these two have no lenses, and they exist. This is a C-fan. This is obviously the Nautilus I showed you before. And basically, they get along without any lens. Lens eyes appeared in chambered eyes as well as in compound eyes. So here, you see the octopus and the vertebrate eye. And in this case, the octopus eye is interesting. They also have a spherical lens, independently evolved, quite an unusual ontogeny of that lens. It's made of 2 pieces embryologically that then come together and make this beautiful gradient of refractive index. They also evolved an eye that has the photoreceptors pointing properly out rather than backwards at the back of the eye. And here is our eye and the red-tailed hawk eye. Here are 2 very interesting compound eyes, one that is basically a superposition eye where light comes in from several places is focused on this retina back here. Another one which has individual omatidia that focus the light and detect it at that point. So these are 2 main kinds of compound eyes you may have heard about. Then the third kinds of eyes are mirrored eyes. These are really fascinating, and only in the past maybe 20 years has a lot been learned about them. The scallop eye I've talked about already, with a retina here. Maybe could we turn off these lights and we can see this better? Do you know how to turn this one off without causing something to happen? And these are crustacean eyes. And these crustacean eyes are quite fascinating because they also have a mirrored lens, but their mirror lens is a square array of mirrors. So 2 mirrors, if you glue 2 mirrors together, you may have had this experience of going into a clothing store and you see a pair of mirrors glued together like this. You can never escape it. That's the kind of lens that these animals have, and we can talk later about how that actually works, but it's turned out to be really an incredible, interesting solution to a problem. For many years, decades, people thought crustacea had no lenses. They were actually couldn't see them in the fixed form. You couldn't detect these mirrored lenses. So despite the great variety that you see in the world, these are underlain by only 8 fundamental kinds of structures, and that's how physics has constrained the biology. So now we want to turn to, does this help us understand the evolution of these eyes? So let's talk about evidence for eye origins and how can we think about this. So I'll talk first about eye development, then lenses, then phototransduction, and then a modeling case of looking at how fast an eye might evolve. So If you look at eye tissue organization, this is a wonderful summary by Dan Nielsen in Current Opinion in Neurobiology, where we have representation of the origin of the tissue, either neural or epidermal, the kind of photoreceptor cell, and these are similar to vertebrate cells or similar to invertebrate cells. And this is for the four main kinds of eyes. So vertebrate eyes, where an invagination of the brain is the neural tissue that produces the retina, and ciliary photoreceptors are plugged in there. The lens, however, comes from the epidermis. If we look at cephalopods, they have their retinal tissue from somewhere else, and they use an invertebrate kind of photoreceptor type, a microvillar type. Arthropods have invertebrate photoreceptors and make their retina out of a different tissue, basically epidermal cells, and though they produce their lenses also out of epidermal cells, their crystalline cone lenses. And polychaete tube worms actually have vertebrate-type photoreceptors and a lens-like body that's produced. It's not yet known entirely where these all come from. So we have the origins of eye tissue suggest they must have come from different places, that they're really not at all clear. If there were one source for eyes, that you wouldn't have a similar way of building those eyes across all animals. So the next question is, well, and I alluded to this in the short history of eye evolution, so if developmental molecules are conserved, can that help us understand eye evolution? So as I mentioned, Walter Garig in 96 proposed this master regulatory gene was PAX6, and since it was in the cascades of many animals, including Drosophila, where it's called eyeless, and PAX6 in mammals, it was seen to be then sort of central to the way eyes develop. And these PAX homologs are certainly do share conserved functions across all phyla. But does having these common genes being recruited for some functional purpose allow us to conclude that the eyes are monophyletic? So here's the probably the best studied way that of knowledge about eye development. This is the genetic cascade that controls development of the Drosophila eye. And there are just a set of proteins here that interact positively or negatively, feedback loops. A lot of this is known. It's a beautiful story that's really pretty well understood. And as you can see, PAX6, which in this case is EY, if we look at the genes that are capable of causing ectopic formation now several years later, it turns out that all of these that are circled can cause ectopic production except for sinus oculus, so that not just PAX6, but all of these genes can induce ectopic eyes, meaning PAX6 alone is not at the top of some hierarchy. It's pretty interesting and important for thinking about the way genes control development. They act as a collection rather than as individuals. And importantly, if any one of these is absent, you don't get sort of a part of an eye, you get nothing. So it means that this gene network is essential for making an entire eye. Any one of these genes can induce that whole eye. So starting anywhere in this pathway, it can induce the whole thing to happen. And so it really was quite a different picture than we had 6 years earlier when we only knew about PAX6 and its role. In vertebrates, there is now the similar kind of list of genes that are essential and when they occur, both in time and in space. And the same story is turning up, that there are a number of genes responsible. PAX6 plays a role in this invertebrate genes as well. But several others have been recruited that are quite different, and they all have interacting features. Yeah?
And the evolution of this network we are going to discuss?
No. The question is when I'm going to discuss the evolution of how this evolved. No, because it's not actually understood where it came from. I'll give you my ideas about why it is not how it works.
Isn't there a contradiction in those two statements that if every one of those genes can induce eye, then if any one of those is missing, then eye is not formed?
I think it's only a contradiction if you imagine there has to be a hierarchy of how they interact. So I think that diagram, what that really tells us is that this diagram probably underestimates the number and kind of interactions that are here.
Isn't it like having a keg and a party? You know, you have a keg, you have a party, you have some parties, and you get a keg. But if you don't have parties and you don't have a keg, you don't have a party.
There's your answer, okay. Can I use that? Okay. Okay, so what about lenses? So you can imagine now that we have this highly conserved set of auxins that exist across all kinds of eyes, and they are pretty important for photodetection, and they are well understood and cloned, and they can give us some idea about how those eyes are related to one another. What about lenses, which are pretty much a really important feature? So here's a picture of a spherical lens from the fish that I study, actually showing it, focusing these four laser beams in blue, and that's perfectly corrected for spherical aberration, as opposed to a glass bead here, which has a uniform refractive index. And this is what first led people to realize that they had to have a gradient refractive index, which has a really interesting mathematical distribution from the center to the edge. So the edge has to be roughly the refractive index of water, so you won't get much reflection back from the lens. And the center is basically like your fingernail, about 1.56 refractive index. So you go from 1.33 to 1.56, and the way you make that gradient produces this fixed focal point only if you produce it in the right way. This is shown for one color of light. This still has chromatic error, and the chromatic error is corrected in an interesting way by having zones in the lens that actually correct chromatically slightly differently. And obviously for a spherical lens, a spherical bead that has a constant refractive index, you have focal points here or there.
That's more fishy.
This is in a fish, but I could have shown you, I've done this in octopus and cephalopods. All animals that live in water have come to the same conclusion that you've got to have a gradient or you won't get a focal point.
Including mammals?
Yeah.
How is the gradient formed? How's
the gradient formed? So these are just, you'll see in a minute, it's a really interesting question that initially we thought they would just extract water. So if you just extracted water, you'd be able to have the right kind of gradient. That turns out not to be the case. Because this lens is not a fixed size. It'll go from being less than a millimeter to several millimeters. So you can't then add water back or something like that. So that's not how it's done. It's done by genetic control, and it looks like different kinds of proteins are folded and added at each stage. Okay, so what about lenses? Well, it turns out lenses, and this is a sort of scientifically interesting, people who studied lenses thought they would be able to get at the evolutionary story pretty quickly, but they are kind of a ragtag collection of other stuff that's just been used for lenses. So they're called the crystallines because people imagine they would have some sort of special feature, but they are enzymes, they're stress proteins, they're all kinds of things. So invertebrates, the one that seems to be ubiquitous is related to a heat shock protein. Vertebrates have others that are other kinds of proteins, and in many taxons there are specialized proteins that have been sort of recruited to become genes, become lenses. And this Graham Wistow coined the term gene sharing because this enzyme, for example, still functions in its other role in the body, but the genes express it in the eye to produce a lens. So this was why people who had studied lenses and hoped there would be the same kind of wonderful conservation as there was in the opsins could never get anywhere because it wasn't the case. All of these were being drawn from other parts of the genetic program. So each time a lens emerged, it appears that other kinds of proteins were recruited. This begs the question of how recruited proteins get assembled into something like a lens and have the properties of a lens. But if you attempt to try to make phylogenetic trees, here's a good example from Sean Carroll, where some make sense. So the lizard, crocodile, and bird, for example, seem to have some common ancestry. But if you look at the relationship of the genes used for crystallines in these humans, they don't mimic the normal phylogenetic relationship among those animals. So they seem to have been recruited even within the mammals in some way. So fundamentally, the way the lens is built is by taking other proteins and through some still unknown mechanism, eyes evolve a genetic program that's allowed to recruit or able to recruit these genes into making lenses. Okay, so what about phototransduction? Could we find some hope there? This is probably the most powerful set of arguments that have come into play here. So basically, we know there are two main pathways for transducing light in animals. All of them rely on this molecule here, retinol, where when a photon strikes this, it's lengthened by 5 angstroms. That retinol sits in a pocket in opsins. And it's a pleasure that Jerry Jacobs is here. His work has contributed enormously to understanding how this works. So this molecule alone has a responsivity that's sensitive at 440 nanometers. But it's held inside this set of pockets of the 7 transmembrane domain, this protein here. And the way it changes wavelength sensitivity is by a set of canonical amino acids that Professor Jacobs and his colleagues have worked out, showing that a handful of amino acids tune this chromophore to give us the different wavelength sensitivities. So this extraordinary story is that these opsins, which are different only in a handful of amino acids, actually when they combine with this retinol molecule, can give us a whole range of wavelength sensitivities. So it's really an incredible thing. And basically invertebrates, we now know there's a family of opsins called the cone opsins, or sea opsins. They're ciliary, meaning they look like they are on hairs or something like that. And they have a signal amplification stage, which includes a G protein, phosphodiesterase, and cyclic GMP. So the phototransduction case occurs. So remember, this is this 5-angstrom lengthening that's transduced into a suite of biochemical changes, which provide a massive amplification so that all of our eyes are capable, ultimately, of seeing one photon on average. So it's an incredible sensitivity because of this amplification stage. The signal to the nervous system is that sodium channels close, and there's a drop in current. So your eyes are, when your eyes are closed, constantly producing current, and that's turned off when they interact with light. And the membrane potential hyperpolarizes. This is a dreaded moment when students are learning about neurobiology, and they've just understood about neurons, and then they have to understand this is backwards. It hyperpolarizes to have its effect, and it also is graded rather than an action potential. So this is the common transduction cascade for all vertebrates. And in invertebrates, there's a second class of opsins called rhabdomeric, or R opsins. They have a phototransduction cascade that's different, uses a different G protein, a different pathway. And the amplification occurs here upon opening the channel. So the signal amplification occurs right here, and it acts in a sensible way. Current increases, and it depolarizes the membrane. So these are two very different pathways, each of these cascades associated with a particular kind of opsin. So prior to a few years ago, everyone imagined that this is the way it was, that vertebrates had this and invertebrates had that. But Detlev Arendt, who you hear from on Wednesday, looking at a marine ragworm, found that there were two opsins expressed in this animal. And here's the phylogenetic tree showing that one is a C opsin and one is an R opsin. And they are in the eyes of the rhabdomeric opsins, which you'd expect for an invertebrate. But he found in the brain that they had a vertebrate-like opsin. And the genes that are associated with the transduction cascade appear also to be expressed here, although that's not as clear yet. So in invertebrates, all of the animals seem to have these two primary cascades. Rhabdomeric associated with the eyes and ciliary associated with the brain.
So what do they do in the brain?
It's not known. It's suspected. And you'll see from the data I'm about to show you, this is the brain opsins are thought to be associated with circadian rhythms, although maybe Todd knows more. Nope.
Okay, so, but
amazingly, both opsins, both pathways are also true in vertebrates. So Daniel Burson at Brown University made this amazing discovery, and it's summarized in this picture here. This is a cartoon of your retina. These are the rods. Here are the cones. That whole system, which has been studied for 100 years, is the form and structure of determining what's going on in the world. It's our sort of what we call our form pathway. And Burson discovered these cells in the ganglion cell layer that are photosensitive. And he discovered this because he and a student were working. They had an electrode in this ganglion cells. and they had cut off this part of the retina up here, and someone inadvertently turned on a light in the room, and the cell fired, and they could not imagine this had happened. But it was more than that. It wasn't just that these ganglion cells were photosensitive. They were photosensitive with a different kind of opsin. So they used the invertebrate type of opsin, the class of G proteins associated with the invertebrates, and basically the whole transduction cascade looks the same. And Dennis Dacey then went and looked at human autopsy material and discovered that human retinas also have melanopsin. That's another term for a class of invertebrate type photoreceptors containing ganglion cells. And they projected to the brain, to the LGN, the SCN. That means the SCN is the suprachiasmatic nucleus, which is the site of the circadian clock. So it's thought that these contribute to the circadian clock signaling system. And but now in recent work, they've shown that they also respond to illumination and color. So amazingly, we have in our eye two kinds of photoreceptive systems, both these melanopsin types and the traditional conopsin types, and their corresponding transduction cascades.
So this is invertive corresponding to invertebrate parts?
Yeah, so basically you have a little bit of fruit fly in your eye.
Yeah, I understand, but in the, you said in invertebrate, the one that were in the brain where you...
Right, right. So
the second reason, so that would be invertebrate.
Yes, so that it's now thought that these invertebrate photoreceptor types, so this invertebrate cascade here in fruit fly eye is actually present in these ganglion cells, some ganglion cells, about a fraction of 1%, and are thought now to control actual circadian rhythms, possibly pupillary response. They're mapped onto a set of ganglion cells, and so there's a lot of work now to try to figure this out. Yeah.
As far as cascade attention, shouldn't one be looking at them in the broader scheme of things, including other sensory modalities? Like in the vertebrates will have trip type cascades involved in taste and things like this, right? Other olfactory and taste senses employ very similar cascades. So I'm not too comfortable just associating it very tightly with two different opsin types.
Sorry, all I meant to say was I was using that to distinguish the C opsin from the invertebrate opsin, not that these are dedicated photo detection systems. These cascades, G protein, PDE, CGM, GGMP, are in all animals in lots of places. Yeah, so it's just to distinguish these two as being different that I made that point. But I'm aware that they're not committed to this.
But I guess maybe I'm trying to understand the problem on its head a little bit. Given that there seems to be such opportunism in the system, why are these cascades so tightly associated with the opsin? You can imagine that certain G protein coupled receptor can pop into a cell that has a certain transduction system and start responding to light or taste or whatever. So why are these things so concerned, whereas so many other things are not concerned at all?
Here's my answer, which is it's not known why that is, but it appears that once, and you'll see my crummy metaphor for this in a few minutes, but basically, once something works, it's conserved in the nervous system. So I think the argument is basically, once these two got associated and this cascade evolved, then they remained in association. And the same is true here. And that's a weak argument, but it seems to be the evolutionarily conserved way to do things, that whenever two processes get associated, then those happen. And I will argue that in fact, even the role of PAC6 is because it and its friends were able initially to associate opsin with retinol with a structure that would hold them. Right? So you're right, it's opportunistic. But it's not clear why this didn't have to be this way. This could have been this cascade, right? But we can't run the clock back and find that. So what I think is amazing about this, and it's a new way of thinking about sort of evolutionary processes, is that these two I types, as I call them here, collaborate. They don't compete. It's not as if in evolution there was one winner and a loser. In both invertebrates and invertebrates, we now can think of this as two solutions to getting energy out of light and into the nervous system, acting together in some complex way, depending on the organism and the particular phylogeny. So in both invertebrates and invertebrates, these two canonical I types collaborate, and they harvest and deliver information from photons to the brain, and that's really what their job is, and so that's what they've done. But it's novel to have them not have a single outcome. And I'll just digress for a second to say that this is so antithetical to how scientists think, that many years ago, maybe 30 years ago, people actually, Kiefer Hartline, recording from scallop eyes, recorded from two layers of the retina, and got two different kinds. He got hyperpolarizing and depolarizing kinds of responses, and reported that, and no one made much of it, but now we know that in the scallop, both of those photoreceptor types appear to be present, and they are both acting along these separate cascades. So basically, a long time ago, the data were there, but people were unwilling or blind to it. Okay. So how can we think about the repeated use of similar genes in evolution? So I would say that, this is my speculation, that the ancestral source of photodetection probably involved PAX6 interacting with opsin to somehow activate its expression. And my conversation with molecular biologists revealed that they don't have a sense yet of what that means. How is it that a constellation of a family of genes has a special ability to make things like this happen? And so we can imagine that with increasing eye complexity, I think PAX6 began to be confined to photoreceptors. And it sort of suggests that these conserved genes have been recruited independently. So the cephalopods are a good example. They diverged from vertebrates a long time ago, about 750 million years ago. And fossil records suggest they didn't have eyes for about 400 million years. And when they got around to making eyes, they basically used a number of the genetic backgrounds that vertebrates have used. And a recent study from a Japanese group showed that the cephalopods have about 75 genes conserved from their common ancestor 750 million years ago, and those are involved in eye construction. So when they got around to making those eyes, they used these conserved genes. So following that interlinked genetic pathways, I didn't talk about those, but there are lots of evidence now that these are involved regulating complex events. But I think that similar strategies don't imply common ancestry, but they're really reusing efficient mechanisms evolved for similar tasks. So, and it may be just the consequences of a small genome, that there are not a lot of genes around, so you just reuse things. And those that have been selected because they have a very good or successful way of combining particular proteins will be used that way. So I think gene interactions are like an improvisational acting troupe. You get together, they act out a scene. If it works, they keep it. And I found this. Here's an improvisational acting troupe. And the votes here are both negative for this particular scene. But you can imagine over the course of evolutionary history that this is kind of what happens. Multiple times something gets tried, and when it works, it's kept. So how fast could an eye evolve? So a lot of speculation has been around how fast could this occur. And Dan Nielsen and one of his students made a model, which is the only one I'm aware of, that tried to look at how quickly you could get from a flat photosensitive pigment spot to a vertebrate eye, and proposed you could get there in about 2,000 sequential changes of 1% in length, width, or protein density. So that their speculation is that an eye would evolve in about 500,000 years, which is like nothing in evolutionary time. And here is the pictures that they published in the Royal Society in 94, showing that with really very few assumptions, you can get quite far in producing an eye. So speculation, basically, opsin preceded the rise of bilateria, and rods and cones, that is, ciliary and rhabdomeric photoreceptor subtypes existed prior to that, and then radiated into all three major branches. And so we basically have to say that since both eye types existed prior to the rise of bilateria, there's really good evidence that PAX6 is not some sort of ancestral gene, but there are multiple origins of genes at this in this stage. I'll just mention in passing, I didn't talk at all about cryptochromes, which is another way of getting photons into energy. There are some fish species that actually use cryptochromes. So these two may turn up to be important in eyes somehow once we can figure out how to find them and look at what they're actually doing. So here's how I think about it, that there was in the beginning an opsin photopigment, and then evolution of receptor cell specializations, and that probably involved PAX6 and EYA, leading to what we now know as ciliary and rhabdomeric photoreceptors, leading to single-chambered eyes in vertebrates and jellyfish, for example, compound eyes, clams, etc., rhabdomeric photoreceptors in cephalopods, and compound eyes in trilobites, insects, and crustaceans. And of course, this is the major pathway. You now know that we also think that all of these probably ended up over here, and these all ended up over here. But these are the main image-forming eye types that arose from a primary opsin, then branched to these two kinds of photoreceptors. So, and I'd say that also the story isn't over. So if you look now, there are, these are the genes, the opsins I've been talking about, the R-opsins, the melanopsins, and the C-opsins. And basically, that's only two of seven opsin families that are known to exist in us, not to mention all the other vertebrates. So these other families are probably also engaged in converting photons into neural energy, and we just have no idea actually how that happens or where they're even expressed. And that's probably what we'll discover in the next few years, is actually where those are occurring. Paropsin now appears to be part of the another aspect of the pineal gland light detection system. So I would say that probably eyes evolved many times, maybe hundreds of times, and we know of at least two eye types, and they were present before bilateral organisms, so that it must be that there's not a monophyletic origin. And there may be even more types of photoreception once we learn about the other opsin types and cryptochrome function. So the conservation of gene excitement may have been a red herring, reflecting gene improvisational rather than real developmental, in the solution of developmental problems, not actually an origin idea. So as Darwin would have put it, eyes are owned many times, and the evidence is in our eyes. And what I thought I'd do now, there's a little time left, so if you would like, I can talk a little bit about this alternate universe, since this is a group of people interested in physics. There's another whole universe out there of light detection. I've been talking about what we call type 2 opsins. There are also type 1 opsins. They're present in all domains of life. Their progenitors existed early before the divergence of even archaea, eubacteria, and eukaryotes. And there were previously four known examples. Now, because of Craig Venter's sequencing of large volumes of the ocean, we know about something like 800 of these opsins. So what are they? They're closely related to one another. Here's a phylogenetic tree, but they have no relationship at all to type 2 rhodopsins in animals. Here's what they look like. Also a 7 transmembrane domain protein. They have a binding pocket, also with a shift base, just like ours does over here. Different in weight. There is some conservation across them, but no conservation at all between the two molecules overall. They also use retinol, so this vitamin A derivative retinol, but here they use it by going from all trans to 13 cis, whereas we go from 11 cis to all trans. So basically they're using the same chromophore to do the transduction of photons, but in a different way with a different subtype of that chromophore. They're positioned in the membranes differently, so archaeas are, these are the 7 transmembrane domains, how they sit in the membrane for cow, frog, squid, and for a couple of bacteria rhodopsin, the halo rhodopsin. So clearly, these are all common, sitting in the membrane the same way. These are all common, but they're different from one another. And they transduce light into things quite differently. They have basically proton pumps, they are moving the animals, they're connected directly to flagella in a couple of cases. So their photosensory system is quite different from ours. There's no kind of cascade of amplification. So the similarities are that the proto-rhodopsin and rhodopsin, both photoisomerized retinol, and they have shift-based proton transfer with different acceptors. That means where this retinol is attached in the opsin. Helices CNF are both implicated in both cases, and both have helix F most mobile, but whereas we have gone to a signal transduction cascade, they actually go to direct membrane-embedded transduction. So they're clearly a whole different family. This may mean that evolution discovered retinol twice, and when it's salvated with a 7-transmembrane domain, it's useful for turning photons into other forms. And this likely reinvention could be because retinol has its inherent properties as a photon converter. So that raises the question, are there other ILAC structures still to be discovered, possibly in these bacteria rhodopsin? Will we find other ways of this other type of retinol opsin combination producing sort of some kind of photon?
Kind of a bacteria that can have eye structures, or dinoflagellates have eye structures that are made using those bacteria rhodopsin actually.
Yeah, cool. So maybe you'll hear about this tomorrow. Okay. So I think I'll stop there. This is a colleague of mine, Mike Land, who drew this to try to figure out the evolutionary landscape, and we can talk about that if you'd like. So I'd welcome more questions. Yeah?
A question, 40% of the cerebral cortex is anchored to vision in humans.
Yeah.
So what happens in other types of animals that have less evolved brains and all that? How do they separate the brains into the processing of the vision? What are the evolutionary forces actually that trigger this specialization of vision?
So the most compelling set of arguments were done by the Max Planck group, which looked at number of genes devoted to olfaction in primates and across a whole range of species, and discovered that it may be that brain space, which is radically different in animals depending upon their evolutionary histories, is limited. And in us and in our close primate relatives, we've given up a lot of genes encoding olfactory processes. And apparently that's been because we couldn't sustain building that big visual system and the large number of genes required for olfaction. So we have 1,000 pseudogenes in our olfactory genome package that seem to have been turned off. They argue that it's been turned off because of the vision overcoming that. So that's a PLOS paper that's quite interesting that addresses that point. Meaning, there's been a lot of correlational studies, so you can look at, for example, the naked mole rat and show that it's a blind animal. It only has the SCN that's still working. And in animals like the blind cavefish, where you implant an eye bud, they can reconstruct a visual system, but it's not nearly as good as the one that their living relatives, their phylogenetically related animals that live with eyes, actually have.
But in terms of proportionality, Hymenoptera insects, flies, bees, and so on, have a huge proportion of the brain that's in the visual system.
Yeah.
Probably half or more.
Yeah.
And so in terms of, that's why your question seems to have to do with proportionality. That's not at all a feature exclusive to.
But also when you have a blind person, when a person becomes blind, and the visual cortex reorganizes itself and becomes more sensory and more
to a limited extent, yeah.
Yes, and they become much more sensitive to sound, to smell.
I think that the jury's out on how much there is. Certainly, reorganization. How much there is a question. But heightened sensitivity has definitely been documented. Yeah.
So you're explaining these two different opsin pathways with their own amplification mechanism, and one of them seems that although they were believed to be one vertebrate and the other one not, eventually both are found in both cases. So what is the advantage of mixing them, or what kind of behavioral implications are there versus using one system versus the other? Is this understood? Is it
that's hard because I think we don't. So it's not as if
one species has a fundamentally better or more reliable or there's no functional feature that distinguishes them. So they're not better, more efficient in moving photons or any aspect of that. They just happen to have emerged. And they happen to have been, one has been selected for form vision in invertebrates, and one is selected for form vision in vertebrates. And the other one is along for the ride and doing other stuff where you need photons.
But they are totally equivalent in terms of energy consumption.
Maybe someone can tell us. I don't know.
Well, in the dog, it's very difficult to tell because it's dark on average on the Earth half the time and light the other half. And so the vertebrate ones are working flat out in the dark, and the vertebrate ones are working flat out in the light. The cones are working flat out in the light too. So it's very difficult to pick on energy grounds. The one advantage that people have found, and this is pointed out in a nice paper by Dan Eric Nielsen and Daniel Osorio, that you can be a single photon detector, you can be a rod and a cone if you're an invertebrate ciliary photoreceptor, because you can photoregenerate or photokeep them, which means you don't have to hold on to it. You can hold on to it very tight. Whereas if you're a cone, you have to let go of your photopigment very quickly so you can regenerate it, which means it's less stable. And I think that's the only real advantage that we know.
Yeah.
And as an invertebrate person, I'm looking for.
I mean, there are other, the way the photon detection systems are packaged clearly have a different in a serious way. So you might wonder, where did the compound eye come from? And the only evidence we have, a suggestion we have, is that you started with a pigmented eye cup. And so for vertebrates, they got bigger and added more receptors. For invertebrates, they were just duplicated. And hence, you have that fundamental difference between the two of them. And I think Simon showed you that you no longer think that faceted eyes have one big, millions of little pictures of the dialogue that goes in there, but one leads on the lead. Yeah, something puts on the lead. Sounds great. Yeah. Yeah.
I guess I still wonder whether there's something to be learned from lodging the question from sensitivity to light to sensitivity in general, right? So there are lots of G-protein coupled receptor systems and so sensory systems, and they have some great level of similarity. So if one sort of decouples from the morphological aspect of compound or camera or of the eye and just focuses on the light receptor, then it would seem to be naturally part of a family of other receptors. So olfactory base, and then there will be some sort of classification of different receptor types. I guess there are five different base.
Well, I think the way to think about this is that all of these have solved the problem of getting information from outside the cell to inside. And that has been solved with the seven transmembrane domain proteins, whether they are synaptic receptors or they are olfactory receptors. All of those are trying to get information inside the cell. So if you want to step back that far, yeah, these are just part of that family where we have a modified seven transmembrane domain protein. The way they found the olfactory receptors was by using opsin as a probe for looking for them. So it was also predicted to be a seven transmembrane domain protein sensory. But the big question is how you get information across the cell wall. And this has been a major solution.
So based on that answer, don't you think in some ways the question, how many times did eyes evolve, is the red herring? Because we can't answer that question because there are shared features like opsin, like GPCR signaling. And there are features that are new in lots of lineages like lenses, crystallines, for example. So maybe it just can't be answered in that distinctive terms, unless like what you did where you defined, an eye as an image-forming eye, then yes. But still, it's, I don't see it as much of this improvisational, well, it is, but you know, there is a shared history.
Yeah.
There is still a shared history.
Yeah, I took the, I didn't talk about this in detail, but obviously I'm thinking of Ives as at least having two photoreceptor elements with distance between them so they can detect two different things and have some resolution. And if you look at light detecting spots, there are probably millions of those in many organisms that never turned into eyes along the path. So I think the issue here is that the reason that this is important is not because we want to solve eye movements. It's hard to even think about what that right term would be to have a critical test of these ideas. But because it reminds us that knowing genes that are responsible for our development of the program probably don't instruct us very much about evolutionary origins.
Yeah. Well, I was going to follow up though on both of Boris and Todd said that there is some evidence for shared origins being sensory in general. Because if you go back before bioterriers, cnidarians have a PAX gene that's fully capable of functioning like PAX6 in functional experiments. They have these sort of combined sensory structures, depending on which group of cnidarians are talking about. But their PAX gene looks like it's a precursor for any of the types of sensory cells that appear in this Ropalian structure, be they mechanical or visual, and probably chemo, but they're less well known. The PAX genes go back even further before metazoans because they're present in trigoplasts, which doesn't even have things that are recognizable as neurons, but has this class of cells that maybe have some proto-neuronal characteristic. So you actually can see some associations of these functions, at least, going, having a kind of a root that's that's much less differentiated. So there have been some long-standing associations that we can then imagine differentiating from each other.
Right, but then over evolutionary time, they became specialized, and it's used, I mean, PAX6 is used in building with Ellen all kinds of places where it's expressed, so then it became sub-specialized into things that it did well. So I mean, those are not contradictory arguments.
Yeah. Just going back to the comparison of the absence of the olfactory receptor, one of the things that intrigued me is that when, I believe it's when the retinol is bound, it causes it, that's the dark state, and that causes depolarization, just like when you bind your light into an olfactory receptor, that causes the depolarization. So to me, it's always seemed like maybe if you think of the opsin as an olfactory receptor molecule, that kind of would, in a way, almost explain why it's sort of causing the hyperpolarization instead of the depolarization, because the light is causing the light to float away.
Yeah. Although in the olfactory receptors, if you look at the difference in residues that are associated with particular kinds of olfactory responses, they're not limited in the way that we have the chromophore pocket and these residues that the Jacobs group has discovered that really are the ones that define its responsiveness. So I think there are a family of, I don't know how many, 15 key residues that are make everything happen between retinol and opsin, and with the olfactory receptors there are 800 or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, the animals are living in deep sea. Do they have PAX6 and opsin? Do they have any light collection?
We barely know what the rest of them are. Most of them have huge banks of rods. Giant, because they can't make an eye big enough, they have enough receptors. They have tubular eyes that have stacks, like 15 layers of rod photoreceptors only. They're quite amazing. There's one fish that was discovered that has layers of rods on the surface of its body. So then you have, you know, they've taken the eye and put it back outside the body to get closer to the photo. So no one has any idea about the genes related to those.
Haven't they captured a new chromophore? deep sea fish captured chlorophyll or something.
Well, no, there are, Ron Douglas says this paper showing that cryptochromes are actually used in some of them. So cryptochromes is other kind of pests as well. It's a pretty important thing, light. So it's not surprising that photosynthesis all happens at the same range of wavelengths. They're all vacuumly bound.
Yeah.
The design of this gray, it's refractive index lens. Is there any acute effect? So if you grow such an eye in the dark, is that as good as, or is it all pre-programmed?
You have to be careful. Yeah, we've done that experiment. that's actually, it's governed by the green cone in the fish that I studied.
Ah, so the sensory end is used to shape the
effect. Yeah, so it's actually under regulatory control. In fact, so is your eye, the shape of your eye. If you were raised, can you see being John Malkovich?
Mm-hmm.
So they work in this place of very low ceiling. People who raise birds in low ceiling places show that the bird's eyes distend, so that's the far point for their eye. It's a dynamic process. It's controlled by the lens, which is trying to get the farthest thing you can see in focus. And so the eye responds to the lens once the lens is formed, and the lens responds to the eye as it's growing. So in the fish, they grow continuously, so they have to make the spherical lens bigger and bigger and bigger, same with cephalopods. But once your eye is an adult, basically it can be adjusted.
How local is that feedback loop? Is it the feedback
Well, you can tell it's hemispheric, so the top half of the eye being having a near point will cause the bottom half of the eye to move away and try to get that into focus. But they have not tried small spots where you have to put a lens on to make it then appear something's really close within a small area. Yeah.
For those vertebrates that have direct photoreceptors in the gray for circadian protection, do they have regenerative type photoreceptors in those structures?
Those are all ciliary. So yeah, the pineal is all ciliary.
I should know this because I think the guys at UC Irvine, but I don't know, this idea of using a visual system to detect magnetic fields, is there something?
In the bird world, the question has been, can the opsins be used to tune the magnetic receptor system?
Something like that.
Yeah, and so it turns out, yes, they can, in a number of cases, the migratory birds actually calibrate their magnetic sense with their visual sense. Okay.
Yeah. So there's coffee across and let's come back at 3:30 for